persons and creation. I don't think that we can know a person without knowing at least something of their history. You don't have to know their entire history. But to know someone is to know their history. So to know, really know me, to know what makes me tick, you have to know my history. And I think that creation is the same way, that we can't view it as a static thing without a history. We're just dealing with what's in front of us. We have to understand how it got there. So that's my basic point. So what I'm going to try to do is illustrate this by reference to our local environment currently. We live in what's called the Flint Hills area of eastern Kansas. And this is what it looks like. A hilly region with these terraced hills, one of the few remaining areas of virgin tall grass prairie in North America. So I'm going to use this to kind of put a little flesh to my remarks. So let's do that. So in this case, we look at the landscape of an area. And that landscape is a consequence, is a result of the geology of its underlying rock. And I'm a geologist, a paleontologist, so obviously this is something of interest to me. But what we see as our local landscape is a consequence both of its underlying geology and of its climatic history and its erosional history. So if we look at the Flint Hills area, this is a typical rock exposure of the rocks underlying the Flint Hills. And what you see is a series of alternating layers of limestone, more resistant limestone, marine limestone layers representing ancient shallow marine conditions, and a variety of different colorful variegated mudstones and siltstones that record a range of different terrestrial environments. And these are repeated dozens and dozens of times. Okay, so what you have is a layer of limestone, and then these less resistant mud rocks and siltstones, and another layer of limestone, another layer of mud rocks, repeated multiple times. And so what this is actually recording is alternations between terrestrial and marine conditions over a considerable period of time, during a particular time in Earth history called the early Permian, late Pennsylvanian and early Permian, and I'll come back to that. Those limestones, many of them, are characterized by these abundant layers of chert or flint, and that's what gives the name Flint Hills. Okay, what's called the Flint Hills. These limestones slowly weather, dissolve from precipitation and groundwater, and what's left behind is a mantle of these chert or flint nodules. So the ground has a mantle of these very chemically and mechanically resistant chert nodules that mantle the whole landscape. And that's what gave it the name of the Flint Hills. Also in certain areas in northeastern Kansas, you'll find things like this. These are glacial erratics. These are actually Sioux quartzite, which was carried all the way down by the continental glaciers from South Dakota. And these are a reflection of one of the evidences of these continental glaciers, which rerouted drainage systems, which transformed the local topography. And then in between those episodes of continental glaciation during the Pleistocene, illustrated by this view of a continental ice sheet today, which covered this region, interspersed between these advances of glacial ice were the erosional effects of running water, okay, which are now active again. So those two erosional agents are what responsible for sculpting out the Flint Hills. That landscape, in turn, which is a consequence of both this ancient geological history going back 280 or more million years, and the more recent episodes of erosion which stretched over many millions of years. That landscape is in turn sets the kind of the ground rules for the biological communities that inhabit them today. And ultimately also our human history and culture. So, for example, if we go to the Flint Hills, we find tall grass prairie, such as illustrated by the stand of Big Blue Stem, which tends to lie both in the river bottom areas where they have thick layers of sediment, so they can have these very deep root systems. You'll also find them on the sloped areas of this terrace topography, which overlay these soft mud rocks, representing those ancient terrestrial environments, which erode more deeply. But at the tops of those terraces, which are over the limestones, you have shortgrass prairie, having an entirely different ecosystem on those two different types of rocks. And in addition, notice this line of scrub trees and bushes are associated with the limestone layers. And the reason is those are the local aquifers. The water doesn't flow through the mudstones. It flows through dissolved passageways within the limestones. That's where the springs break out. And so that's where trees get their start. They have a more constant supply of water. So you can just stand and look over the landscape and do geology without ever picking up a rock hammer. You can pick out all the rock layers. You can pick out, you know, all the tree lines. Each tree line represents a limestone layer. You can do the geology from, you know, satellite image. You don't even have to, you know, go look at the rocks because the vegetation tells you what the underlying rocks are. Now to kind of back up again and look at the geology, that geology is going to provide evidence of the complex history of the Earth at a range of timescales. Okay? Those timescales range from things that are occurring over millions of years to processes that are occurring on orders of thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years. So a whole range of different types of processes in Earth history, biological, climatic, tectonic, that are all operating at a variety of different timescales. So the rocks of the Flint Hills are primarily from this time period, again, early primitive and also late Pennsylvanian. The world was very different then, dramatically different. Continents were all in different places. In fact, they were joined together into a single megacontinent called Pangaea, that straddled almost from pole to pole. It had a large range of towering Himalayan-scale mountains that cut across this supercontinent, the remnants of which we now call the Appalachian Mountains. And it was also, interestingly, like the more recent Pleistocene, it was an ice age, one of the two major ice ages in Earth history. And so there were advances and retreats of glaciers during this time. So these climate cycles were going on at periods of tens to hundreds of thousands of years. Continents were migrating, mountains were eroding, things happening at a variety of different timescales. Life was very different. Not only were continents very different, life was very different. Late Pennsylvanian was a time of the coal swamps vegetation that covered much of the Earth's surface. Large proportion, the majority of all the coal on the face of the Earth was formed during this time. That coal was formed by the accumulation of organic matter, primarily terrestrial plants. And all that carbon, which we now mine, all that carbon, which is now coal, was taken out of the atmosphere. That was ancient atmospheric carbon. Okay, taken out over tens of millions of years out of the Earth's atmosphere. Not only was plant life different, animal life was different. Paleocaesars were the kind of bully on the block at that time in Earth history. Oceans were very different. The dominant life forms in the seas were very different from what they are today. There were reefs, but built of entirely different things. Modern corals didn't even exist then. Reefs were being built out of things like sponges and brachiopods and other kinds of interesting animals. And interestingly enough, at the end of the Permian, most of these beasts, as well as the animals and plants that I showed you earlier, went extinct. At the end of the Permian, the largest extinction in Earth history, that extinction was probably a consequence of a runaway greenhouse. So that history is not irrelevant to us, okay? Because what that history does, it not only is part of the history that got us where we are now, including that extinction event, but it also gives us key to how the Earth changes at a variety of different timescales. And that evolutionary history is recorded in the fossil record, and it's also recorded in life today. It's recorded in the composition of today's ecosystems. It's recorded in the anatomy and behavior of each organism. It's recorded in the amino acid sequence of every organism on Earth, okay, as a record of that history. So, again, look at the Flint Hills. More recent history, retreating ice from the last Pleistocene ice age. North America was dominated by this megafauna, which lived in the periglacial environments. And much of that megafauna has gone extinct, both because of climate change and also because of the invasion of humans from Asia. So today we have some remnants of that ancient megafauna, for example, the bison, and other organisms. Again, many of them are remnants, sometimes same species, sometimes different species, but remnants of this Pleistocene fauna, which now inhabit the plains and comprise our existing ecosystem. As well as the plants. Okay, very diverse ecosystem, very diverse vegetation. Again, as a consequence of that history, the plants that are there for a reason. There's an historical reason why those particular plants are there. So understanding and caring for that creation that we now have, that environment in which we now live, is important part of that understanding is understanding this natural history. And it cannot be properly or fully understood without understanding that dynamic history. Nature is a complex of interacting systems, each of composed of a whole lot of interacting entities, each of which is responding to each other as well as to an environment which is not static. Nothing is static. That's the point here. Absolutely nothing is static. Everything is changing. Environment's changing, climate's changing, organisms are changing, ecosystems are changing, soils are changing, everything's changing all the time. And so to understand why we have what we have, why do we have the current tall prairie ecosystem, it's maintained by those complex changing interactions. Grazing by bison was a major factor in giving us the grasslands that we have. They affect the composition of the plants that dominate the prairie. They're selective eaters. They modify by their activity. They modify the soils. They create buffalo wallows that produce unique wetland areas and wetland plants that only exist because the buffalo maintain the buffalo wallows. When the buffalo went extinct, those wallows disappeared, and when they reintroduced the bison into the prairie, the wallows reappeared, and so did their ecosystems. They regenerated these ecosystems that existed only because the bison were there. Fire. Prairies maintained by regular fire. So if you don't have grazing, if you don't have fire, you don't have the prairie. And we're just learning that. That's one thing that Kansas State University is doing, is exploring what are the things that maintain the prairie. You take grazers off, you take fire off, the prairie will no longer exist. Okay? It's maintained by those interactions. We are part of all this. The idea that somehow we honor creation by withdrawing from it somehow, I don't know how you could do that, and withdraw our influence and just let it go is what we should do, is nonsense. Because we impact it whether we want to or not. We are a part of the ecosystem whether we like it or not, and we make dramatic impacts on it whether we like it or not. So the question is not, do we mess with it? You know, are we lords of creation or not? We don't have a choice. We are whether we like it or not. How do we exercise that lordship in a way that sustains and preserves and redeems rather than destroys? So understanding that dynamic processes of the natural world and the time scales at which they occur enables us to understand and anticipate how creation will respond to our actions. How are we going to perturb it or disturb it by our actions? So if we put domesticated livestock herds on that, what's the proper density? What does overgrazing do? What are the impacts of that on the composition of the prairie, on the maintenance of the prairie ecosystem? What about water use? This is an aerial picture of center pivot irrigation systems in Kansas. This is utterly transforming the ecosystem. We're pulling up groundwater that has been there for thousands of years, pouring it out on the surface to develop an agriculture of plants that wouldn't otherwise live there, that couldn't otherwise live there.
Are you pulling up the groundwater faster than it's accumulating?
Much faster. Okay. This is a picture of the High Plains Aquifer. The colors here represent the rate at which water is being depleted from that aquifer. The red colors there represent declines of over 30 feet in 10 years. So in 10 years, the groundwater table dropped over 30 feet where it's red. At these rates, some areas of the High Plains Aquifer will be without usable water in 25 years, and a substantial portion of the whole aquifer will be depleted within 100 years. There will be no water left. Okay. Coal. Remember I said where this coal came from? We're taking coal, which is carbon that was taken out of the atmosphere 380 million years ago, and we're burning it and putting it back up there. Taking coal that formed over tens of millions of years and putting it out within a human lifetime. Okay, so you'd suck out all the carbon out of the Earth's atmosphere over tens of millions of years and then pump it out in one big spurt over one human lifetime. Well, what's going to happen? Oh, no. That happens. The world ends. It's all. No. That was a graph of the carbon dioxide spike. We're likely going to double the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere within our lifetimes. But understanding something in the history, understanding where that carbon came from, helps us see what we're doing, the magnitude of what we're doing. So our existence changes the rest of the natural world of which we are part. By our actions, we alter the ecology, chemistry, climate, even the geology of the planet. If those actions are not informed by an understanding of natural history, we may find that we are destroying the very systems that God has established for the fruitfulness and flourishing of their creation. Thanks. I don't know if I have any time. Yeah.
Thank you, Keith. You talk about stewardship via understanding the natural processes. How are we to infer from that vast array of information then what would make practical choices in stewardship?
Yeah. One thing I mentioned there was scales. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's really important. In other words, the actions that we take have consequences, but are those over what kind of scale will they act? And if we understand how the natural system normally works, how quickly does the climate respond to things? How quickly do ecosystems respond to different kinds of changes? What kind of changes have ecosystems responded to in Earth history? And how do our changes compare to those? That gives us information into the kind of degree of change that we're making. I mean, is this a change that ecosystems are used to dealing with, that can respond to in a way that they've responded to in the past? Or are these changes kind of outside the range that ecosystems can deal with over the time frames that we're talking about? So I guess that's part of the answer, is understanding time scale can help us understand the time scale of our actions.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Somebody made a comment at one point that both Venus and Earth have the same amount of carbon in them in terms of the overall biosphere, but the difference is that Venus's carbon is essentially in the atmosphere, which is primarily CO2, and Earth's is essentially in the Earth itself, but we're in the process of taking the carbon from our Earth and pumping it into the atmosphere. The interesting difference for me as an astronomer is if we look at the position of Venus and Earth relative to the Sun, Venus is a little closer to the Earth, or to the Sun, but the surface temperature is about 900 degrees Fahrenheit on Venus versus our average of, 60 degrees Fahrenheit. And if a lot of people would just say, well, that's just because Venus is closer to the Sun, but in fact, Mercury's average temperature being even closer to the Sun is only like 450 degrees Fahrenheit or something like that. So that it's just a dramatic representation of what that carbon moving from the Earth to the atmosphere does to it.
Yeah, I think it can be, you use that illustration. I think you did need to be a little careful with it, though, as a teaching tool, because there's a lot of other things going on in Venus other than just those atmospheric processes. It has a completely different kind of tectonics, things like that, that are affecting and have affected its past history, creating the atmosphere that it has now. I guess I could use this opportunity to say one thing that I think is important as scientists in communicating these issues to the public is there's a real tendency to exaggerate or to try to be spectacular or something. And that, to me, that's dangerous because if someone comes along and say, no, wait a minute, they're really overblowing this and say, you know, here's a counter to that, you've lost your credibility. So I think it's more important to be as accurate as you can. You know, we're not saying that the Earth is going to turn into Venus in 100 years. We're saying that the Earth's climate is going to rise a couple degrees. One said, well, a couple degrees, what's that? Well, now you can go to history and say, well, realize that during the height of the last ice age was only 8 degrees different, global average temperature, from what it is now. We're saying 2 degrees, 8 degrees between now and the middle of the last ice age was 8. You know, that's pretty significant. So I think exaggeration can be a danger.
Yeah, I think that in a way is an answer to Paul's question: how do you deal with this global warming in a democratic society? And I think what we as scientists have to do is foster a vigorous public debate so that the public gets educated. And democracies don't move fast, but if there is a serious enough threat, eventually people become aware of it, and they do move. But our role is to try and promote public education and a vigorous debate.
I think the media can be used to our advantage in this. I can just tell you my own personal experience as a beekeeper with the scare with colony collapse disorder in the last couple of years. We've seen a tremendous interest in beekeeping amongst individuals. I've gone in my county alone to a beekeeping club of, I think we had 3 years ago, we had 60 people in our club. We now have 250 in one county in North Carolina. We're going to limit registration for our bee schools.
Said if there was no grazes and no fires, then there was no prairie. So what do you get?
Actually, what happens is particularly junipers, but there's other kind of scrub trees as well, will take over. Also, you change fire favors grasses because they can regenerate from the roots, especially these really deeply rooted prairie grasses, regenerate from the roots. Forbs tend to be more severely affected. So when you have a fire, it reduces the number of forbs and increases the number of grasses. So keeping the balance of forbs and grasses depends how frequently it's burned. So if you don't burn it at all, the forbs will take over from the grasses and you'll get colonization by a range of scrubby trees. So you'd end up with a kind of a scrub forest instead of a prairie. I don't know who our next speaker is.
Yeah. Thank you, Keith. And,